And it's hard to perhaps understand that if this man died, how can he be our Messiah? And this was these were two of the objections that the writer of Hebrews was trying to clear up, especially in Hebrews chapter 2. Is it a valid objection to say that Jesus could not be the Messiah because he was a man? And is it a valid objection to claim that he's not the Messiah because he died? And those are two of the things that we're going to address here in Hebrews chapter 2. Let's go ahead and read starting in verse 9. And let's start in verse 9 of chapter 2. It says, "But we see Jesus, who was made a little lower than the angels for the suffering of death, crowned with glory and honor, that he, by the grace of God, should taste death for every man, for it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For both he that sanctifieth and they that who are sanctified are all of one, for which cause he is not ashamed to call them brethren, saying, I will declare thy name unto my brethren, in the midst of the church will I sing praise unto thee. And again I will put my trust in him, and again, behold, I am the children which God hath given me. For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil." Now we're going to stop right there. And let's just kind of review just a little bit of where we are in this book of Hebrews. The Jews who were looking for a Messiah, as I said, had basically two objections. They objected that Jesus was a man, and they objected that Jesus died. And therefore, how could he be the Messiah? Now, we saw last time that the writer of Hebrews answers the first objection. That is, that Jesus was a man. The writer answers that by showing that man has only been brought low for a little while, but that the ultimate reality is that man has been crowned with glory and honor and has a higher destiny than angels. Now that is one of the focal points of interest here in chapter 2. It's the status of man as opposed to the status of angels. So let's just review for a few minutes what we've covered in times past. Now, man was originally created with a lofty rank. I think we would all agree there. And keep your finger in Hebrews, but flip back to Genesis chapter 1. And there was nothing wrong with the original creation of man, of course. God created man. And in Genesis 1, verse 26, it tells us what lofty rank man had when God originally created him. It says, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them," that is men, "let men have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created him, he him. Male and female created he them. And furthermore, when God got through making man, he looked at everything and said that everything was good. So there was nothing low at all about man in his original creation. We were made like God. There's nothing higher than God. And God made us in his image. Now, nowhere in the Bible does it say he made angels in his image, but it says that he made man in his image. And we have intelligence like him. His is much greater, but he made man with a level of intelligence that is far superior to all the animals, as you would certainly recognize by experience. He made man with a conscience, and he made man with a moral compass, and he made man with the ability to fellowship with himself, with God himself. And so we are far above the animal kingdom in our abilities, our ability to reason, our ability to plan. All of that sets us apart because we're made in God's image. And God said, let man have dominion over the fish of the sea and so forth. And so God made man to have things in subjection to him. And it said, let man have dominion over everything, over all the creeping things and so forth. And so God gave man in his original creation dominion over all of these things. But amazingly, in Hebrews, it says in verse 7, it says in verse 7, thou madest him, that is man, thou made him a little lower than the angels. You see, in verse 6, it's clearly talking about man as a human being, not Jesus, but man. It says in verse 6, what is man that thou art mindful of him, that insignificant creature, man, or the son of man that thou visitest him? Thou madest him, that is man, a little lower than the angels. So it says man was, actually the way it's worded in the Greek, it says that man was lowered. So man was made in his original creation, and then at some point man was lowered. That's the kind of the sense of the Greek. That word made lower is actually one word in the Greek, and it means to be decreased or to be lowered from some original position. So there was man in the Garden of Eden. He was made in the image of God, and then man sinned, and the writer of Hebrews says that thou made him lower. His rank or position was lowered. So this idea of making lower is that Greek word eletao, which means to decrease or to bring to a lower station. And so it seems that man fell from that lofty rank to his fallen condition. And that condition apparently places him in some ways lower than angels. It says in verse 7, thou madest him a little lower than the angels. And the question would be then, how so? How so is man lower than the angels? We talked about that quite a bit last time, and I think we came to the conclusion that it is not a matter of being made lower in terms of your nature, because it also says a little lower down that Jesus was made a little lower than the angels. And we know that Jesus never gave up his godhood. He was always God. He was always omniscient. He was always all powerful. And the angels never were. So it can't be that they were made lower in terms of their nature. But they were made lower in some sense. Well, when man fell, of course, he came under the wrath of God when he sinned. Man became subject to the dictates of the law of God. That is, he was under the penalty of the law. And this certainly placed man in a worse condition than the good angels. You will remember that the angels, it says in, I think it's Galatians 3:19, that the law was ordained by angels. And in other places it says that the angels are the ministers of the law. So God used the angels as intermediaries to give the law unto men. And yet men, when they fell under that law, under the penalty of the law especially. So here are angels who are mediating the law. Men are now under the consequences of the law. So perhaps in that sense, men are lower in rank, in that sense, than the angels. The law is certainly in view here when it mentions in verse 2, chapter 2, verse 2. It says, for if the word spoken by angels was steadfast, most commentators think that refers to the law that they spoke, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, and so forth. So the law, the angels are closely associated with the law. So how are men lower than angels? Well, because they were subject to the law that the angels spoke. Not only this, though, there is a there's another way that men are made lower, and that is that death passed upon all men. When Adam sinned, death passed upon all men. And so all men must die. And angels don't die. Angels were created in their original condition. The fallen angels will experience eternal death in that respect, but they will never die like human beings die. So men are made in a condition to where they will die. And therefore, in that sense, they are lower than angels. But I want you to notice that man was lowered in this condition only for a little while. This is what it means when it says in verse 7, "Thou madest him," that thou made man, "a little lower than the angels." Now, when we see it written like that, we think, well, here's the angels, and we're just a little bit down from that. Kind of a matter of space, right? But the Greek word means either space or time, a little bit in time. And most people, I think, and rightfully so, believe that this means that man was made for a little while lower than the angels. It makes more sense in this context, I think, that man was made for a little while lower than the angels. So it's only for a short time that man has been lowered. Look at verse 7, Hebrews 2:7. "Thou madest him," and let's just go ahead and, if you've got a Bible that has notes, you'll probably have a note there that says, "or for a little while." "Thou madest him a little while lower than the angels," and then what did God do? What's the second half of verse 7? "Thou crowned him with glory and honor." So there is there are both circumstances right there. Thou made him for a little while lower, but then ultimately God crowns man with glory and honor. In fact, God sets man over the works of his hands in the last part of verse 7. And in verse 8, ultimately, God subjects all things under his feet. I think speaking of man here. Now that's quite a bit different than angels. Look up in angels in verse 5. "Under the angels hath he not put in subjection the world to come," you see. But men will have all things in subjection to them. So it seems here that man is lowered for a little while. Thanks to the redemptive work of Christ, the condition of man need not forever rank below angels. It is only for a little while that he is lower, and then man is raised to a rank above angels. That's the thrust of this passage. So man was lowered temporarily to a rank below angels, but through redemption is raised to quite a higher rank. This is the message of this passage. You might think of it like this. Man was up here when he was originally created. Then man sinned and his rank fell down here. Then Jesus redeemed his people, and those people have been raised up again to an even higher ranking. And I think we'll see that as we study this passage. And that is a great salvation that he has given to us. This new ranking is higher than angels if you compare verse 5 to verse 8. Man will have all things under his feet. Angels will not have all things under their feet in the world to come. Now, although this reversal of rankings has already been accomplished, you will notice that it uses the past tense in verse 7. It says, "Thou crowned him with glory and honor, and did set him over the works of your hands, and you have put all things in subjection under his feet." But the place where this reversal will be clearly seen is in the world to come. That's evident from verse 5 when he's talking about angels. "Have he not put the world in all things in subjection in the world to come?" You see, the world to come is where all of this will be seen. The ranking will be clearly seen then. But it's not so clearly seen now. As far as this world is concerned, we don't really see it. And that's seen in verse 8. Look at verse 8, the last statement in verse 8. But now we see not yet all things put under him. That is, under man. We don't see that yet. Now, through redemption, our rank, which was below angels in some ways, is now higher. It is now higher by position right now. By our association with Christ, we're already higher. And angels are our servants to some extent when we are joined with Christ. That's clear from verse 14 of chapter 1. Look at 1:14. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? So you see, there's a sense in which we have already been made equal or joint heirs with Christ. And angels are our servants even now. But in the world to come, it will be by sight. All things will be in subjection to man, but all things will not be in subjection to angels. Now, this is obviously a very encouraging word to us. And it's encouraging to those of us that have not yet made it to the world to come. Now, they see it. They are in glory and honor, and they see it there. We see it by faith only at this point and by believing God's word. But there is a wondrous and a glorious future in store for God's redeemed. And this passage seems to indicate that it is far greater than we can possibly imagine. We don't usually think of all things being in subjection to us. We think of it being in subjection to Christ. And it does say that of Christ in Ephesians 1:22. It uses the same language, and it says that all things have been put under the feet of Christ. But in Hebrews, it's saying all things are going to be put under the feet of man. But we don't see it yet, it says. We will be crowned, it says in verse 7, with glory and honor. Can you imagine that? That you are going to be crowned with glory and honor. It doesn't seem like we deserve it, does it? It doesn't seem like we're worthy, but we're worthy in Christ. You see, we get there based on His merit, don't we? And all things that are available to Him there, all things that are unto Him are also unto us. And so God has crowned us with glory and honor. God has set us over the works of God's hands. Now that's an amazing thing. The works of God's hands, that is all things that God does. Apparently, men are going to be over the works of God's hands. We are going to be God's emissaries. And He will send us out to do His administer His universe, apparently, because we are set over the works of God's hands. That's His entire creation. The works of God's hands is everything that God does. And it seems that man will be His administrators. Man will truly have dominion. There will be none higher than man except God Himself. It seems that we will have plenty to do, for we will be over the works of God's hands, it says. Now, God may send us here and there to do His works, and He will send us with full authority and with full power. The heavens and the earth will obey our command. And there will be no principality, nor power, nor angel that will not be subject to our command. We will be emissaries of God's will, and we will carry out His will in the universe because it says we will be set over the works of His hands. Now, that's an amazing concept, hard to comprehend, and I'll just let you chew on that for a little bit. But it also says in verse 8 that we will be put in a position over all things. Thou hast put all things in subjection under His feet. That is the feet of man. But here is the problem. We don't see it. We don't see it right now. You see, but now we see not yet all things put under Him. And here is the situation. The place where we will see the exaltation of man is in the world to come. In this world, we don't see it. We see man's humiliation here. Here we see man brought down to a place lower than angels. We see man subject to death here and subject to the law. But there is a place where every living creature will see the glory and the honor of man. And man will be highly exalted, and that place is in the world to come. Now you see, much of the Bible is a story about God moving His people from one place to a more glorious place. From a place of bondage to a place of freedom. From a place of hard labor to a place of rest. From a place of subjection to a place of dominion. From a place where we don't see all things under Him to a place where we see all things under His feet. From a place where we are lower than angels to a place where we are higher than angels. Such is the great redemption which we have in Christ Jesus. Now, Jesus never spilled His blood for angels, did He? Never redeemed one of them. If they sinned, they fell, and there was no redemption for them. But He did for men. Jesus never suffered death for angels, but He died for men. Jesus never redeemed the fallen angels. They are reserved in chains, and they will be cast into eternal fire. But He redeemed pitiful human beings like us. And so, it is redeemed men who are exceeding higher than angels. And though we don't see it now, we will see it in the world to come. Jesus said, if you might remember, "I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you unto myself. And where I am, there you may be also." So we are here, but we're going to be there. And that is the story of our redemption. And that's the story of the Bible. That story is pictured beautifully in the story of that earthly people, Israel. In their infancy, they lived in a foreign land called Egypt. But their destination was where? The land of Canaan. And when they were in Egypt, they were in bondage to the Egyptians. And they were not free men, they were slaves. But there was another land where they would be free men, where they would be conquerors and masters of all they surveyed. But they needed a deliverer to deliver them out of Egypt. And along came Moses, who was a type of Christ. And Moses delivered the people out of Egypt with a mighty hand. And they began that journey from the land of bondage to the land flowing with milk and honey. And Moses saved them out of Egypt. You see, they were down here. They were going up there. But there was a journey that they had to take in order to get to that new land. The lands didn't abut one another. There was a space in between, and they had to travel that space. And they journeyed through the wilderness. In an earthly sense, they were saved out of Egypt. But their faith was tested in the wilderness for a period of time. And then they were finally brought to that promised land. So you see how closely this parallels our own Christian experience. We were in bondage to sin. When we were lost, we were in Egypt. But God has promised to save us out of bondage and take us through a wilderness before bringing us into that new land. We were down here, but God is taking us up there. Now we have been brought up out of Egypt, but we have not yet reached that promised land, have we? We still are sitting here on earth. And so Hebrews says, we see not yet all things put under Him, because we haven't reached that destination yet. We haven't reached that world to come. We are still in the wilderness, if we equate to the analogy. We are still on our journey. We have not yet seen that land that is flowing with milk and honey. But we're going there. God led Israel through the wilderness, and God is bringing us to that heavenly land of which Canaan was a type. And that's what it says, isn't it, in verse 10. Look at Hebrews 2:10. It says, "For it became him for whom are all things and by whom are all things," that's God the Father, "in bringing many sons unto glory." There's the journey, you see. The sons were somewhere else, but God brings them to glory. And this is what God the Father is doing. He is bringing many sons to glory. There's a promised land out there, and God is bringing His sons there. He is transporting sons from Egypt to Canaan, from a world of bondage to a world of freedom, from a world where we are under subjection to a world where all things are under subjection to us. And that's quite a change. But here's the trouble. We don't know the way there. We don't know how to get there. Furthermore, we are not equipped to get there in our own power. We are like pioneers. If you remember back in reading about the old days, that when the West had not been settled yet and no one knew the way really, they just took off and wondered where they were going. We're like those pioneers that are trying to make our way through treacherous, mountainous territory. And we don't know our way, and we don't know about the dangers along the way. And so we must hire a guide. When they would get, especially to the mountainous areas, they would hire guides to take them through because they didn't know really how to work their way through these wildernesses. And so we must have someone who knows the territory and is able to get us to the other side, that being heaven. And this is what God has done for us. He has supplied us with a captain who will take us there. Look at verse 10. "For it became him," God the Father, "for whom are all things and by whom are all things, in bringing many sons unto glory, to make the captain of their salvation perfect through sufferings." You see, we have a captain that takes us from where we are to where we are going. Now, Jesus is our captain who will get us from here to there, just as Israel had Moses to bring them out and take them to the promised land. God's children have Jesus. Now, this word captain is an interesting word. It's archegos in the Greek, and it carries with it two meanings. Its first meaning is a captain in terms of rank. He is our leader. He is the chief. He's the one we follow. He's the general and we're privates. Or he's the captain and we follow him. But there's another meaning to this word captain. And it's again, it's a captain in the terms of time. In other words, he goes before us and shows us the way. And this is what Jesus did. Jesus served more as a scout to scout out that territory and to go there first and experience all things himself and actually make it himself so that he could bring what we're called his brethren behind him, sort of like a wagon train, and he's the captain. And he takes us there and he goes there first ahead of us. This is the idea that's found if you'll flip over to Hebrews 6:20. Hebrews 6:20, it says, "Where the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus." You see, Jesus was the forerunner. He was our captain that went out there ahead of us and got the job done. And then he brings us along in our time. So Jesus outranked us, of course. He was a man, but he was also God. He was our captain, and we follow him. And he has gone ahead of us, and he has entered that land, but we have not yet entered. Now remember that Hebrews has told us in Hebrews 1:3, the last phrase, it says that Jesus has sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. Jesus has gone from here to there. He has sat down there. He was our forerunner, and he has gone before us. So it says that now we see not all things put under him, that's man, And that's the last part of verse 8. But what's the next thing it says? But we see Jesus crowned with glory and honor. You see, Jesus has gone before. He has made it. He's there. He is crowned with glory and honor. And all of that was as a forerunner for us. We're coming later. Right now we don't see us, but we see Jesus who is there. Jesus, as our captain, went before us, and now he has sat down on the right hand of the majesty on high. He is in that promised land. Was it Joshua and Caleb went out before and spied out the land? Jesus is already there. And he is bringing many sons there. That's what our passage says. This is a place of great glory and honor. And now we see Jesus there, and we will follow there soon. So let's put this in the context. There are perhaps some Jewish believers that the writer of Hebrews is writing to, and they are being persuaded to return to Judaism. And they are being told that Judaism is the true and permanent religion. The law of Moses, they say, is better than the grace of Jesus. The law, which was administered by angels, they say, is better than the gospel that was brought by Jesus Christ. And they say that Jesus could not possibly be the Messiah because he was a man, and angels are ranked higher than men. Not so, says the writer of Hebrews. The ultimate destiny of man is much higher than angels. Man is lower only for a little while. Then he will be raised up in glory and honor. All things will be put under his feet, but all things will not be put under the feet of angels, verse 5 says. It says, look at Jesus. He is the forerunner, and he has sat down at the right hand of God, and that is the ultimate destiny of man through Jesus. All right, I have a whole another section to go, but I'm not going to wear you out here tonight. I'm going to stop right there. The next objection that we're going to look at is whether the fact that Jesus died proves that he's inferior to angels. We've already seen now that just because Jesus was a man doesn't make him inferior, because men, the ultimate destiny of men is higher than angels. Next, we're going to see that the fact that he died didn't make him inferior either, because he died not for himself, but for others. All right. I'm going to have you stand here, and let's be dismissed in a word of prayer.